Hello and welcome to Season 9, Episode 12 of the Ubuntu Podcast. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the BQM1011 tablet. We'll also have some command line love and go over your feedback. I'm Laura, and joining me this week are Mark.
Hello.
Martin.
Hello.
And Alan.
Hiya.
Hiya. So, Mark, what have you been up to?
Well, it was sunny last weekend, so we went up to Stratford-upon-Avon.
Ooh, fancy.
To see Shakespeare?
Not to see Shakespeare.
No, he's dead, Laura.
Yeah.
Oh.
I think we walked past his tomb, but it wasn't clear that that's what it was. But yeah, no, we just walked up by the river and then sat in the pub and watched lots of people failing to row boats that they'd hired.
Is that rowing or punting or...?
No, it's you can hire little rowing boats and just go up and down the river there because it's quite calm. But there's a pub with a beer garden right next to the river as it goes under the bridge, and you can just see people who've just hired boats but have no idea what they're doing, just going round in circles. It's good fun.
Excellent.
One guy got a round of applause when he eventually worked out that you don't actually row the way you're facing.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah.
Noob.
Mm. Martin, what have you been up to?
I've been playing games. I've been playing Star Horizon and Grid Autosport.
What are they?
Star Horizon is a predefined route through space where you have to blow up aliens. Well, actually blowing up artificial intelligence stuff. It reminds me of a game from sort of the early 1990s where it sort of took you through a route through space and all you had to do is aim at things and shoot and watch the explosion. So it's nice and simple. It's good for an old man like me.
Is it like first-person perspective, like Starfighter, where you're like flying straight
you're positioned behind your spacecraft.
Right, so yeah, it's like Star Fox or something.
Star Fox.
Yeah. And it's very good fun. I mean, I'm not a massive gamer, but it's quite simple and it's very satisfying explosions.
You were employed because Tony left the show and you were expected to be our game journalist. I mean, oh my God. How has it been this long since we've now found out you're not big on gaming? Carry on. Okay, well, see if you can redeem yourself with telling us about Grid Autosport.
Well, Grid Autosport is a racing game, and that's pretty much all I play. The only games I really play are racing games, and this is a very good one. So I've been having a lot of fun with that. I found out I'm no good at the at racing against actual people in multiplayer online stuff, but I've been enjoying the career progression.
Is that because you're an old man, and everyone else you're playing against is like 8 years old, and...
All they do is play.
Yes. Probably. Right. Mm, yeah, and I've also won keys for Tomb Raider 2013 as well.
But that's not a game you play.
It's not a game I've played yet, but I have won keys for it.
How did you win the keys?
I had to win a game of cunning and skill on the internet. Basically, I had to retweet something with a hashtag.
Really?
Do you know, awesome. It's funny, I once did that, and one of the people who followed me at the time and who is a sponsor of the show, hello Andy Smith, has a policy where he will unfollow you if you ever retweet anything or tweet anything which is a competition. And sure enough, as soon as I tweeted it, it popped up in someone's notifications and they said, oh, Andy will be unfollowing you. I was like, straight away, he's a man of his word.
This was a retweet for Linux Gamecast, so fellow podcasters in the Linux community.
Awesome. So are you going to redeem the keys and play it yourself?
I have just received the keys, yes, and I'm going to have a go, yeah.
Cool. And I believe that was written by Terry Pratchett's daughter, that Tomb Raider.
Which one?
The newest reboot-y one with...
What, the game storyline was written by his daughter? Really?
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting fact. Did not know.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. Shall we get on with it? So in previous episodes, we've mentioned the first Ubuntu tablet to hit the market, which is the BQM10. We've mentioned this previously, but now they've started showing up in people's hands, including journalists who've been reviewing the device and end users who've been playing with the device and developers who've been creating applications. And so there's been a bunch of reviews and commentary about the device and the software and everything that goes with it. And I thought we should maybe have a meta discussion about those kind of things. So just a brief summary of the hardware, because we've mentioned this before. It's a ARM-based MediaTek processor, which goes up to 1.5 gigahertz, 2 gig of RAM, 16 gig internal storage, 10-inch multi-touch display, full HD. There's actually two incarnations. There's a HD, which is 720p, and a full HD, which is like 1920 by 1200. 8-megapixel rear camera, 5-megapixel front camera, and a 7200 milliamp hour LiPo battery. So that's the hardware. Now, with all of these, normally, we talk about this with an air of authority because we've played with the device, but actually only one of us out of the four of us has actually played with this device, and that's Martin. You have one, don't you?
I do. I have it right here with me right now.
What do you think about the hardware?
In terms of the hardware, I'm very impressed. The build quality is excellent. So the only 10-inch tablet I've used is my father-in-law and brother-in-law's Samsung Nexus 10.1. So that's my sort of reference for a 10-inch tablet. This is much lighter and thinner, so it's much more comfortable to hold and use. The buttons are all in the right places, in my opinion. The cameras are decent quality for tablets. The screen is very, very good. I think the screen is a standout feature. I've got the full HD model. And the processor is definitely fast enough. So in terms of the hardware, I've got no complaints. You know, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, it's all fast. It's all good stuff. The build quality is really very good. The got stereo speakers at the front. And the box and all of the bits it came with was really nicely presented.
Does it come with a decent charger, headphones, any of that stuff? What actually comes in the box?
No headphones. You get a charger and some introductory material. But it's just well packaged in terms of it can survive the journey and it looks nice and it's just thoughtfully, done.
Okay, so that's the good news. from the articles that popped up, there's a few articles. We'll link to them in the show notes. And there's a mixed bag. There's a couple of positive ones, but let's have a look at the negative ones first. So I think in summary, you could probably pull all of those together and maybe say that some people thought it was too slow at some operations. Some people felt the UI was laggy, that scrolling speed wasn't very good, or it became slow when you opened a bunch of applications.
I think having used Ubuntu for devices on other devices, I can't attribute the slowness to the device, but more some of the ways in which the actual operating system works.
Right.
So when you've got, and this is certainly much, much faster than any other Ubuntu for devices thing I've used. And I've only used it on unofficial, well, I've used it on the BQ phone as well, but that wasn't particularly well spec'd. But in terms of the devices I've used, this is by far the fastest, and it's very, very good in that respect. And I think as the software improves, the hardware is going to be more than capable and up for the job.
So, right. But the problem is that the thing is shipping now, and people mm-hmm. are buying the thing now, mm-hmm. and the complaints are now. People mm-hmm. aren't buying it to say, I'll buy it today and it might be faster tomorrow, or it might be mm-hmm. faster next week. So, for example, Terence Eden on his blog wrote a review where he, tried a bunch of things. There were some bugs, clearly there were performance issues, but there were also some things that just didn't work properly in his eyes. And so he returned it. So, there's you being who you are, and the fact that you know some stuff about the project. If you think about other external people who just see it mentioned online and think, okay, let's give this a go, I want a Linux tablet, and they mm-hmm. buy it. If they're, put yourself in their shoes, can you see Terence's points about how it's, not necessarily performing well, and maybe there's some bugs with the released version?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've encountered my fair share using this and other devices. And certainly the performance stuff is a problem. That's been there for a while. You know, whenever you launch anything, there is some time for things to warm up and get going. And that's been
make it sound like there are valves in there.
Yeah, well, it's what it feels like though, and it is frustrating. And that issue with pre-forking the launching of the applications, I see lots of sort of paper cuts. You know, there used to be a lot of focus on the Ubuntu desktop years ago about fixing paper cut issues, and I see a lot of paper cuts, but collectively they spoil the experience. And so the startup time for the applications is certainly one. Some of the speed at which the swiping in to choose your applications to respond, that's generally okay, but in a desktop mode when you've got your mouse and your keyboard and all the rest of it, that stutters a bit.
And speaking of keyboards, I know Terence pointed out one of the bugs that he discovered was that the keyboard doesn't sometimes come up with the XMIR-based, like, traditional desktop applications, because it ships with some X apps as well, like LibreOffice, Firefox, and XChat, I think. And yeah, he said there were problems sometimes with the keyboard coming up, which is a bit of a problem on a tablet device when you haven't got, if you're not in like the convergence mode, you don't have a Bluetooth keyboard handy. If you're sat on a train and you want to like bash out a document, you might think, I know, I'll open up LibreOffice and no keyboard comes up. I mean, it's a known bug.
Yeah.
But those kind of things are quite showstoppers for many people.
Yeah.
We've said that there are quite a few negative reviews. There are some positive reviews who kind of, where the reviewer obviously sees the potential of the platform, but even there, they're saying it's about what it could be if all of this stuff was fixed. It's not necessarily what it is now as a device for people to go out and use.
Mm.
Right. But expecting people to pay, you know, £200-300 for a device and then say, you know, just wait. In a couple of months, this is going to be amazing. But, you know, I think that's unreasonable. Yeah. And so I think it's okay that, you know, we get these negative reviews. You know, sometimes we need a kick to say, look, you know, we can't ship stuff out like this when there are bugs which are so obviously user-facing, like a keyboard not appearing is just, that shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, the most obvious issue for me is that the tablet generally will only work in landscape orientation. So web applications will rotate, but the native applications won't. And that's clunky. And that really doesn't...
When you say native applications, you mean like the Dash itself?
Yes. And for example, I can't think of examples, but some of the pre-shipped applications don't rotate. Some do, but all of the web applications do. Right. Rotate.
So I'm going to be that guy and tell you that in the upcoming OTA 11, it does rotate because I have a BQ 4.5 and I know that some people with the Nexus 7 have been complaining that it's fixed in portrait mode.
I first encountered that on the Nexus 7 and I was surprised when it wasn't resolved in this shipping device.
That's an example of, you know, one of those things where, you know, it's just been not been a priority to make the Dash rotate, and now that it does, right, that's one more ticked off the list. And you know, if you were to, you know, put yourself in cryostasis for a year and then, you know, wake up in a year's time and then pick up the tablet, I'm sure there'd be a bunch of those things fixed. But
I didn't realize that you got a job in marketing.
I'm speculating. I'm not saying that they will be fixed. I'm speculating that some of them might be. But, you know, it's horrible for us who work on this thing to look out and see, you know, people spending their hard-earned money. And this is not a cheap device. It's not like a $25 Firefox phone that you can put in a drawer and forget about the fact that you bought it. This is a good couple of hundred euros, €200-300. It's not a small amount of money. And to pay for something and it not work, if you've got the faith and you're okay about knowing that you can file these bugs and they will get looked at. And another problem, Terence filed a bunch of bugs. unfortunately, they were filed in inverted commas, the wrong place in Launchpad. And so nobody saw them. And so he was frustrated that he didn't get any replies on his bugs.
Mm. Hold on. Where is the right place if Launchpad isn't the right place?
Well, there's a zillion projects on Launchpad and he happened to find...
Oh, the wrong project.
Yes. And so, you know, now we know about them. I mean, and some of them are just duplicates of existing bugs and some of them are already fixed and all that kind of stuff. I'm not trying to make excuses. I'm pointing out that it's frustrating to see that someone in the community or outside the community is having those kind of frustrations, and it pains me to see that.
So the performance issues, like the lagginess and things, would you say that they're hardware not being up to, not the spec not being good enough, or is that software as well?
No, I think the hardware is perfectly fine. I think that the issues, it's more the perception that things are slow rather than things are actually slow. So when you've got an application that's running, like Firefox, for example, you have Firefox running or LibreOffice and you have your Bluetooth mouse and keyboard plugged in an external monitor, and it's as responsive as a desktop system because they're not all that demanding in terms of their, you know, requirement for inputting stuff and things being rendered on the screen. So those work perfectly well. It's the perennial problem with Ubuntu for devices that when you go to the app tray and you launch something, it takes several seconds and it doesn't seem to matter whether you've got the latest and greatest BQM10 or the original BQ4.5, that takes the same amount of time.
And there are certainly, I mean, I'd agree with Martin. I think this is, there's a certain chunk of this, which is a software problem that, and I know there is a team in Canonical whose task is to look at all these performance issues from top to bottom, and some of them are problems with code we've written, some of them are in the Android drivers, some of them are in the Linux kernel, you know, they're all over the place. It's not like there's a magic button we can just press in Unity 8 to say make it faster. This stuff is spread top to bottom in the stack, so it needs a lot of disciplines to cover those kind of things. It's a hard problem to solve on a, you know, a little ARM device to get the squeeze the absolute best out of it. And some of those, you know, I'm sure will iteratively get better, which is why I say, you know, you put yourself in cryostasis and in a year's time, a bunch of those bugs get fixed and suddenly, oh, actually app startup is much faster and you can swipe between stuff. But, you know, we're talking about now.
If we take that, for example, so the very first time I used Ubuntu Touch, I use Amazon heavily, do a lot of shopping for day-to-day stuff on Amazon. And the Amazon app that was installed a year ago only did Amazon.com. And there were half a dozen other Amazon apps in the App Store for different locations. And I thought that was a bit rubbish. So I go to the App Store to find the English version. And I thought, actually, I should probably try the pre-installed one. And that one now is location aware. So when you start the Amazon app that's pre-installed on the tablet, you get redirected to the correct Amazon store. And I thought, brilliant, that's great, that's progress, that's one of those issues that's been fixed. So then I do a lot of stuff on eBay. So I go and launch the built-in eBay app, which doesn't work at all anymore because eBay have now blocked the user agent that whatever that web wrapper is using. So you open the eBay app and it just says, please go and install the Android app for this thing.
Oh, man.
And it's like, oh, okay. And then you find that, you know, there are four or five other eBay apps in the App Store made by randoms. But I'm not super confident about installing a PayPal app that's written by some random person on the internet or an eBay app that's written by some random person on the internet. I've got a degree of confidence in those web apps that have been developed by Canonical or the owner of the online asset. But I'm not going to install a PayPal app written by Joe Bloggs.
Right. And you know, part of that like speaks to how the software store is curated, or rather not curated, in that, you know, anyone can just lob something in the store and, you know, so long as it passes all the checks and balances, it, you know, it goes in. And that's something we're going to have to address as more people put those kind of things in.
Yeah, I mean, the Google app, Google Plus is a good example of that. I use Google Plus an awful lot. And I think there are three or four Google Plus apps, all of varying quality, some that have online account integration and some that don't. And in some respects, it's nice that people have got the freedom to create all of these things, but it's seriously confusing because I've now had to make notes of the author's names of the various apps that I want to use so that the next device I set up, I know which version of the Google Plus app is the one that I want to install because it's got the online account integration and all of that sort of stuff. So that sort of app duplication is confusing, and that will be a barrier to, you know, newer users to the platform in the future. So that does need cleaning up.
I think the general consensus there is good ones get voted up, bad ones get voted down. Look for the ones that are voted up.
Yeah, they're all fairly mediocre, unfortunately.
You could do with better descriptions and things as well, I think.
Yes.
Because they do all look the same often.
So I'd be interested to know, you know, direct feedback. I mean, obviously we've read these blog posts and we've listened to other podcasters talk about, you know, their experiences. Be interested to know if any of our listeners have bought one or thought of buying a BQM10. If so, you know, why did you or why didn't you? And let us know your feedback and we'll read that on a later episode.
And now it's time for Command Line Love. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And this week's Command Line Love comes from Dutchie on IRC, who some of you may remember from one of our earlier episodes, many, many years earlier, where he sent a picture of our logo done in the sand while he was on holiday.
This was our old logo, one with the headphones.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. So the Command Line Love that Dutchie sent us is Brute Force Lux, which does exactly what it says. It allows you to brute force the password of an encrypted Lux volume on your system in case you've forgotten the password. So you may have this if you ticked encrypt the entire disk when you were installing Ubuntu. And then, yes, if something disastrous went wrong, you may have then lost the password. So this can be run with a table of words or partial words, or it can just cycle through every possible combination for a given length of password. In that case, it will take a very long time. So it does recommend that you have some sort of idea of what the password might be before you try and use it.
Yeah.
So, yes. This would be a good one for your recovery USB stick, I think.
Yeah. In fact, my recovery USB stick is encrypted with Lux. So there is
You need a second recovery USB stick in case you forget the password for that one.
Yes.
And that just has Brute Force Lux on it.
Yes. I think I might do that just for the lols. I thought this was quite an interesting one. I had no idea that such a thing existed, but the idea that you could, you know, you have a laptop where, you know, maybe if you work in support and one of your customers or, you know, a friend of yours has done an Ubuntu install and thought it was a great idea to tick the, you know, encrypt my hard drive, and they go on holiday for a couple of weeks and come back and completely forget what the password was, you know, rather than nuke the machine from orbit and start all over again, there is a possibility you could recover the volume. And this could also work if you've like created a container, an image that's Lux encrypted. It doesn't have to be like a full install. You could have a, you know, like people used to create TrueCrypt volumes or, you know.
I've got an external hard disk, which is Lux encrypted.
Oh, really? And how does that, like you just plug it in with a USB key and you get a prompt.
Not quite like that. I have a bash script, which it mounts it and then remounts it and asks me for the password, and then it's mounted.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a bit tricky because it also has the
it needs
two commands run basically. So I just write a bash script to run both those commands.
Maybe we should send this to the UK government, who are currently prosecuting a guy for not giving them the passwords to his hardware. Maybe we should send them Brute Force Lux, and maybe they can decrypt his drives. No, I'm joking. We wouldn't do that. Excellent. Thank you, Dutchie, for that Command Line Love.
We love getting your feedback, so please send it to us. Even the pointlessly mean stuff makes us laugh. If it's short, tweet us on @UbuntuPodcast. If it's less short, but please no essays, email us on show@ubuntupodcast.org. If you'd like to discuss some of the things we talk about with other listeners, post on our shiny new subreddit at reddit.com/r/ubuntupodcast, or you can just leave a comment on the relevant show notes on our website, ubuntupodcast.org.
And here is some of that feedback that Laura's just told you about. First up this week, we have D Shimmer, who left a comment on our website, ubuntupodcast.org.
You guys are my favourite podcast, just a tiny bit over the Linux Voice guys.
Yes! Get in.
Mission accomplished, we're done. Go home. He continues, honestly, there is nothing that can make a rough day seem better than a new episode of Ubuntu Podcast or Linux Voice, only slightly behind my wife and grandkids.
Good save.
Priorities. I decided to upgrade my 1604 on about day 3. Hooray! The entire process was boring and uneventful. It just kept on working fine with shiny new bits. It's been my only system since 8.something for creating and editing audio, video, images, and office work. It all just keeps on plugging along and working great along with my virtual boxes and Wine stuff. I played with Mate a bit, and it really looks amazing, though after growing to love Unity, ha! Stick it, Martin. I think I'll hold steady with the standard Ubuntu. I can really see Mate becoming a go-to for a lot of people. And if I ever got a Pi, that's what I'll run.
Awesome. That's one of the nicest emails we've had in a very long time.
Totally awesome. Yeah.
Made me smile a lot.
Yes.
Next, Bitten, at Bitten, on Twitter, tweeted us at Ubuntu Podcast.
Listening now and updated my servers and boxes from 1404 to 1604. Also, Popey, thanks for that at Deb Tips and such, smiley face.
Ah, yes, Bitten hangs out on our Telegram chat and IRC and, yes, lovely person, Bitten. I think he works at Mozilla, actually.
Joan Cybersheep with an I at Cybersheep tweeted us,
I upgraded from Ubuntu Studio 15.10 to 16.10 on a very slow connection, and I took out the third-party PPA, and after 3 hours, no problems at all!
Awesome. I assume that meant 15.10 to 16.04.
Possibly, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, good point.
Nadri Majdor left a comment on our website.
If I'm not mistaken, Visual QML Qt Quick components in an Ubuntu SDK are not based on upstream ones. Is that still the case? Yes, that is still the case, as I understand it. So the entire toolkit on the phone is developed by us, I believe. And yes, that means that some apps are less portable to other QML-based platforms than others. It does mean that there are some apps that are easy to port to us because we're QML. So, for example, there was a nice game that was made for the Yola phone called Petals, and someone ported that and put it in the Ubuntu store, and it just works. You know, there's very little changes required. But I think going the other way would require a bit of work. You're right there.
Nadri Majdor also left a comment on the website saying,
interesting. My podcast player thinks this episode from the Og feed is 34 minutes 01 long, though it does play to the actual end that appears to be 37 minutes 36.
Okay, this is my fault. As a point of order, there are a few. Hashtag blame Martin. There are a few players that can actually calculate OG running time correctly, so we do manually insert the correct OG running time into the feed. But someone, me, forgot to tick the box to activate those manually entered running times for a few podcasts. So I'm sorry, I won't do it again. I'll get it right next time.
Oh, that explains it. That makes lots of sense. Right.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Martin.
John emailed us at show@ubuntupodcast.org.
On Season 9, Episode 7's podcast, at the end of the news was a brief humorous item about yet another Google acquisition that's got terminated. Personally, I'm really glad because I think the Internet of Things is actually the Internet of something else, so I'm not among the casualties. But I expect that folks who paid hundreds of dollars to get their homes automated only to find that Google has turned all their gear into expensive do-nothing boxes aren't finding this amusing at all. The reason the articles you poo-pooed wrote about this as if the sky is falling is that anyone who pays for anything hosted on or reliant on in any way on a remote server is potentially waiting for just this fate. What if your next car happens to be in this category? As far as I can tell, all Google has to say about the bricked gear is, too bad, so sad. You said no essays, I therefore stick a cork in my rant here.
No, it's a completely fair point, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're completely right. You know, when we make this show, we, like just talking about the content that we make here, we try and rely on only our own stuff. You know, we used to use Google Docs and relied on a few other third-party services. And if any of them went away, we'd be, you know, inconvenienced to the least. But for day jobs, if, you know, Gmail suddenly went away or Google Docs went away or some of the other like Hangouts or some of the other internet services went away, we would be inconvenienced for some time. But it's not the end of the world, you know. So relatively speaking, you know, these people who are complaining about Nests and stuff, yeah, they've got a point. But, you know, they're not having to walk to the next town to get a bucket of water. You know, it's yeah. Relatively speaking, in a grand scale, it is a first world
problem. It's a first world problem, yeah. Even so, I fully subscribe to the idea of never buying anything like this that relies on someone else to just keep something running
right
out of the goodness of their heart.
I still want a Tesla, though.
Well, it's not out of the goodness of their heart. You've paid them to run it.
Well, no, you've paid... Well, if it depends on whether you're paying them a monthly subscription for a service... Or whether you're just buying a device and they say, oh, and it connects to this service, don't worry about it. Which yeah, it seems to be the case with a lot of these products.
That's what still what you're buying.
But even if you're paying for the service, then they could quite easily say we've had a business restructure or been acquisitioned, that service is no longer within our remit, therefore we're shutting it down. You know, you no longer have to pay us. Goodbye. Mm. It still can shut down.
But I mean that's, you've bought that product, and if that's part of the product, that's a...
Right.
That annoys me when people say, oh, we could just shut this down. I understand from the business point of view that you can't do something completely indefinitely if you get taken over, but there needs to be some kind of, for this, especially for this Internet of Things type of thing, there needs to be some kind of underwriting thing.
Absolutely. Yes. Bad Voltage had a very good discussion about this. They referred to it as the if we die statement.
Yeah.
And they do this. This does need to exist in the future, I think.
So, thank you for your mail, John. This triggers interesting discussion. I think we should talk about this more.
I think there's a segment in this, isn't there? Martin Groon emailed us at show@ubuntupodcast.org.
Your formatting your boot partition is a bit like the classic format C colon joke. Ooh, I've got a story about that. Beginner's error. Just a thought. If you're Yeah, smiley face. Unicode smiley face, in fact. Just a thought. If you're not keen to use the command line, you should try using gparted. I've not used the inbuilt distro tools in years. Gparted is excellent. Either way, the command line is the best and safest method from my experience. Yeah, Laura.
So, yeah.
Yeah, beginner's First error, off, Laura. You probably don't use computers very much.
Not a beginner. Made clear in the segment, not a beginner.
Also didn't use the command line.
Didn't use the command line. It wasn't because I'm not keen to use the command line, thank you. It's because in Windows, for instance, you can just right-click on a USB key and go format or whatever.
Yeah.
Format this one.
Which is sort of what I expected in an amateur desktop, but apparently you can't do that. So the other GUI is the one that I used, and that had a weird bug in it or a weird... design.
User interface fail.
Yes. And gparted, as I understand it, is for partitioning drives and things, which seems a bit overkill just to be able to format a USB key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair point.
But I guess disks is kind of a GUI version of gparted anyway, isn't it?
No, gparted is a GUI.
They both are. It is, yeah, of course.
It's like a simpler tool than gparted.
Yeah.
But it can still do pretty much all the same things.
Yeah. I have used gparted a long time ago, but yeah. So yes, not a beginner.
Just an idiot. Groon, you have riled Laura. Oh dear, here we go. Jay Phillips at Jay Phillips tweeted us.
I also mistakenly formatted a partition with disks.
Beginner.
And decided never to use it again and to stick with gparted.
Okay. Simon left a comment on the website.
I've just enjoyed season 9, episode 8, and following the discussion about rebooting a laptop only to find it doesn't, I thought I'd mention the excellent QEMU snapshot feature. I've previously written an article about using it to test server bootability, and there's a link to his blog post, but the same idea would work on a local machine, something along the lines of if using an x86-64 laptop, and then he gives a sudo command that I'm not going to read out now.
Blimey. So boot the machine from within the machine.
That's really quite clever.
Does it do it read-only? So you're booted to your laptop already and you're scared about rebooting. Run this QEMU, which does a full system emulation. It emulates a complete computer, but you tell it the computer's hard drive is your hard drive and try to boot. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's really quite a clever idea.
Yeah.
Cool. The cleverest booting trick I've heard of since sticking an ISO in your boot partition and then booting into that from grub.
Jacob F. Roker at Jacob Roker tweeted us.
Can anyone at Ubuntu Podcast tell me if the BQ tablet has an email client and a PDF reader? Yes.
Martin can.
I can. You can use Deco to read email, and PDFs can be viewed with the Document Viewer or Baru, and there'll be links to all three of those in the show notes.
And there is also a dedicated PDF reader. But what?
As in Ant Baru?
I don't know what Ant Baru is.
Star Wars reference.
Well.
Oh, God. Not again. We had the Star Wars reference last time.
It was Star Trek. Come on.
God, Alan.
FFS.
It's easy to troll
Alan.
You guys.
Moving on. Alexandre Enkley at Enkley tweeted us.
Got into Ubuntu Podcast because of some distro on the Raspberry Pi. Nice chemistry. But my Mac Mini 5.2 rejects Ubuntu, went Debian for now. Oh, with no mode set, installed Ubuntu, some derivative, alongside Debian on my Mac Mini 5.2, then went nuts. Under Ubuntu Podcast spell.
Oh, dear.
Mm.
I think that's a good thing.
Good. Yeah, I think that was good. I think that was a good word generally. Cathal left a comment on the website.
Also, Ubuntu Mate, teehee. It is very good. Though I didn't include that in the feedback. Someone has added that in.
I wonder who. Who could have done that thing?
I think that was quoting somebody saying, also Ubuntu Mate.
It's because we said it. Yeah, right at the very end of the show, I think.
Yeah,
like,
because it had
after
mentioned.
We finished recording. Yeah. Yeah. Also, Ubuntu Mate.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ian McAloon left a comment on the website.
Episode 10, Season 9. I was interested to hear the other Squeezebox user. Sorry, the other Squeezebox user is getting the same failed to pass error that I'm seeing on the current season. I'm using, and then he gives the feed URL as the address, and I've tried dropping the terminal. The last slash.
Yes.
As that's how Podpicker displays the address on my Android phone, to no avail. The podcasts that do work on the Squeezebox all seem to end with a generic file name like something.xml or whatever. I've tried a few guesstimates along those lines, but it's either a 404 or failed to pass. I know it's not much to go on and you're all very busy, but I thought I'd reach out to the other Squeezebox user to let them know that he's not alone. Love the podcast via my Ubuntu phone.
Are we starting a Squeezebox community here?
Yes. Thank you, Ian, for the mail.
Right. Yes. So I have tweaked the CDN again, and it absolutely positively avoids all and any caching for the feeds now, including the XML files that are hidden behind those URLs you've sent us. So, starting with the podcast you're listening to now, please report back if it works on your Squeezebox, because maybe it's also fixed those other podcast listeners on other esoteric podcatchers that weren't.
But if you haven't heard this show yet, and you've only heard the last one where Martin told you to write in,
this time
don't write in
again. Yeah.
Until you listen to this one.
So, do we have an unusual feed address?
No, it's linked on the website.
Okay. The feed address is on the website, the front page of the website. And Dietmar Winkler left a comment on the website.
I thought I tried the apt install local package.deb suggestion. For some reason, the apt version that is on my 1604 version does not take it. Using gitkraken as an example, sudo apt install and then the deb file. And Alan, you have some feedback on
yes,
this.
Yes, what you have to do, if you type apt install and then a package name .deb, it thinks you mean go to the archive and get that. If you do apt install and then .slash to say it's in the current directory, .slash and then the deb pack name, and then press return, it will install it and go and get the dependencies as well and install those.
Yeah. So, yeah, as Alan says, you need to give local deb files full file path for it to figure out it's a file, not a package in the archive. But also, I've noticed that apt on its own sometimes doesn't install properly if there are lots of dependencies, and apt get works reliably. So use apt get if you're installing from a local file path.
Cool.
That's a lot of feedback. Let's go straight to the outro. Go.
And that's all for episode 12. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week when we'll have more news, comments, and discussion.
Oh my God, that was a big one.
It was.
Yeah.
The most feedback we've ever had.
3 times as much as our clock said were allowed.
Wow.
So that's brilliant.
So, yes, I hope you don't mind that extra long episode.
Please keep sending in the feedback.
Yeah. If you do mind the extra long episode, send us some feedback and let us know. We'll read it out.
A really long one.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Just sounds like you're going for a wee.
It was very silly.